today on Against the Grain. Her work examines issues of debt and finance, but Cassie Thornton is not an academic or an investment banker, but rather an artist. I'm CS. You'll hear Thornton describe two of her projects, which investigate the nature and impact of debt and banking, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You can talk about debt, you can write about the world of finance, you can analyze trends in banking and credit, or you can make art. You can use that to send a message, to express an opinion about what debt is doing to individuals and societies, to our society. Cassie Thornton has a lot of opinions about debt and financial systems because she's done a lot of research and because she, like many of us, has experienced debt firsthand. Thornton is an artist, a social practice artist, whose projects have raised a lot of eyebrows for their unconventional, experiential, and at times in-your-face aspects. Today, you'll hear about two of Cassie's projects, one that involved hiring someone to have breakdowns, yes, nervous breakdowns, on the campus of the art school she attended, and another that involved touching surfaces in banking institutions and using the accumulated dust and dirt to create drawings of a sort. Cassie Thornton received a Master of Fine Arts, or MFA, degree from the Bay Area-based California College of the Arts, and a BFA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She works under the title of the Feminist Economics Department, or the FED. So what we'll present today is first portions of a lecture that Cassie gave at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and then Cassie will talk with me in more depth about some of the issues raised in that lecture. I want to thank the Evergreen Art Lecture Series for making the audio available. Here's Cassie Thornton speaking in Olympia last October.
So I went to school, I went to undergraduate in University of Wisconsin in Madison. I went out of state. I was the first person in my family to go to college. I think I had about $40,000 of debt when I graduated. And I worked my ass off through my 20s to pay that off. And I paid $15,000 of it off. And then I went to grad school and I went to a fancy private art school, California College of the Arts, for 2 years, where each year was $38,850 per year, and I got about half of that, about $20,000, knocked off for a scholarship. And then I also took out money. I'll explain a little bit about how I used some of my money when I was in grad school, but I got a little extra money to live on, to make work with. But in the end, I think I should only have about $55,000 of debt. Like $55,000 that I actually said, like, this is the amount of money that I want to spend on my education. The rest is interest. The rest is interest, and where is that money going? I could tell you where the money's going, but you could also guess where the money's going, because the United States spends 8% of its entire budget on education. So it's become very, you know, obvious in the news. Like, Elizabeth Warren has made it very clear that the Department of Education definitely profits off of student loans. And, you know, there's lots of different news to read about that's actually really promising about that stuff, like the Corinthian 15 or the Debt Collective, who are getting groups of people from for-profit colleges to strike against their debt really publicly. They're revealing all kinds of information, and they're actually working with the Department of Education in really interesting ways. So a lot about this stuff, I have a feeling, will change. But right now, in the last 2 years, I've accrued $17,000 of interest. And then in the 2 years that I was in grad school, that was another 20. That's amazing. So anyway, I just feel like it's such a waste of time. It's just a waste of time and energy, and it's not real, it's a fiction. And so where does it start? It starts in the financial aid department. I had a very fancy financial aid department at the California College of the Arts. I didn't even take a picture of it because I got kicked out of it so many times. But it was as if in the financial aid department, I couldn't make decisions. I felt like I was surrounded in fog. I was completely detached from myself. I did not have use of my mind. And I said yes to a lot that I didn't necessarily agree to. And over and over again, I had this feeling in grad school of just being covered in fog. And I used to think that maybe the fog was debt itself, but I actually think that debt might generate anxiety, and I'm seeing anxiety. Like, it's like condensation. So I've been dealing with this fog in a lot of different ways. But I think the interesting thing, I mean, one interesting way to think about it is like the sort of motion it creates. Like, you try to move fog out of the way and you can only comb it, but it just comes back. You can't capture it, you can't contain it, you can't actually like consolidate it and move it. It just feels like a familiar feeling. So I did a lot when I was in grad school to try to deal with this fog. Like, I really wanted to cut through it somehow. And I failed in so many ways trying to do it. But one way that I think I really hit it on the head was that I realized that I did not have the power to kind of cut through the fog. Like, I felt like I wanted to scream and yell and like break things, but I didn't have the guts to really like rupture any part of the institution myself. But I did have way more money in my bank account than I was used to. So I decided to hire an actress to play a student while I was in grad school. And so I put an ad on Craigslist and I offered to pay someone $250 to have a breakdown. And so I found this person named Laura, and her character's name was Fedora Archive. And what we did was every Friday, I actually ended up hiring her for the entire second year of my graduate school. And I ended up meeting with her every Friday and telling her everything I was learning about finance, about the school, about the San Francisco art scene. And then she would go and have a very precise breakdown somewhere in the school. The breakdowns happened at the cafeteria or in the hallway or inside of one of my classes. She had a studio that I got her. So she was this sort of interesting, mythical presence in graduate school. And she also became sort of my best friend. And I think we kind of completed each other in a way. Here she is at the MFA show, which should have been my MFA show, but was her MFA show, where we painted the walls black, and all she showed was her resume, her press page, and her biography. And I made all those documents. And when people entered, and they said, well, she approached every person that came into her room, and she would say, you know, have you seen my work? And they'd be like, well, I saw your resume, but what did you make? Like, what do you do? And she was like, is that not enough? And then she'd be like, oh, no problem, I'll get my press kit. And so then she'd get her press page, and they'd look at it, and she'd be like, so, like, how about now? And then they'd say, well, I was really wondering about, you know, what you make. And then maybe she'd get her biography. But anyway, it would go and go, and she'd get more and more frustrated. She really scared people. Like, is nothing I do enough for you? And then every half hour throughout the night, she ended up having a breakdown. And they were timed, and they happened quite naturally because it was very easy to want to have a breakdown for her. But she had this little rug where she would take her shoes off and put her things down and then have a throwdown. And they lasted for about 5 minutes, and they changed in the course of the night. So at first, she was having breakdowns as a baby, as an infant, just using her whole body. And then throughout the night, she got older and more contained. And they were very scripted, actually. And they were really precise in that she, by the end, she was an old person. It was as if she couldn't let anything out of her body. She just shook. She didn't have that same fluidity that an infant has when they can't help but let their emotions take over their entire body. So that was intense, and it was interesting because in grad school, Fedora won a lot of different awards and scholarships, and a lot of people were very upset about it. And I left that project behind, as I do many of my projects, thinking, I can't handle it anymore, it's too much. So I had this residency a few years later at the Headland Center for the Arts, which is an amazing place. And this is my studio. You know, it's like a dream. And I had no idea what I wanted to do in it. In fact, I just felt completely overwhelmed and kind of on parade. I had to have my studio open every day for 5 hours to the public, so it was really hard to work. But luckily, I got this invitation from University of California in San Diego, and they wanted to do a project about student debt. And it was very clear that they were the most interested in doing a Fedora archive project. So I worked with them, and they basically said, you know, they don't have money for performance, and they don't have money for an artist fee. They don't have money for a lecture. They only pay for materials. And I was like, well, the only materials I could give you are breakdowns, and those will cost $250 each. So I am very proud of the fact that I got University of California, San Diego to pay $250 per breakdown for a critique of their school, because that's what it was. So we went to microeconomics classes, or that was the plan. We're gonna go to microeconomics classes, we're gonna go to, you know, the cafeteria where there's a Chase Bank. You know, the whole place is just like a corporate megalomania. It wasn't hard to choose where we would have a breakdown or about what. UC system raised its tuition 300% in 11 years. Like, it's more now, but then that's what it was. So there was lots to talk about. They'd also just hired the former Department of Homeland Security president. Janet Napolitano is the president of the UC system. So there's like a lot to talk about. So, but it became obvious that Lara, the old actress, couldn't do it. She just got pregnant. And I couldn't imagine paying someone only $750 for three performances without paying them to train. And so I didn't believe I could hire anybody for this amount of money. And these performances really changed Lara's life. This was very hard on her body, on her mind. Like, I wouldn't just do this to anybody now that I saw what it was. And then I realized, like, actually, Fedora, I need to be Fedora. Fedora is me. It's a part of me, and I've never done it before, and I'm afraid to do it, so I should definitely do it. So I told them that, and so I decided to become this student who was, like, kind of everything I hated in a way. She was going to be this MFA student who very self-consciously performs breakdowns about her debt on campus. So in a way, she is me, and she's totally not me at the same time. So I made her business cards, and I made her this very forthright social climbing person in my mind. And I got a wig, and I started to, while I was at the Headlands, have meetings with Laura. And so Laura actually was the one that received all the money for the breakdowns. She received the $750 to train me how to have breakdowns. And I felt like it was this really important kind of reciprocity to do this, to go through the same thing she went through, and for her to see me do it and see it happen to me. And so I had a great time. This was me in the hallway practicing at University of California in Berkeley before I went there. I just practiced and practiced and practiced. As soon as I put the wig on, it was over. I have so much that I'm so angry about, and it's so cool to get to have a breakdown about it. So I don't have great documentation about this because I actually told them that they couldn't come. Like, the gallery, I became very close to the curator, Michelle Hewn, who's an amazing person, and she was allowed to come through as the breakdowns were happening, but there was no documentation by the University of California, and it was not for them, it was for the students. So there's very few pictures, but this is a picture of the person standing next to me when I was in the first microeconomics class I was in, when they were talking about how we are going to now believe for the rest of our educations that we are living in a scarcity of time and energy, that we are all economic men, that we will all fight to the death to accumulate more capital than anyone else, that we must expect these conditions to kind of be the most basic conditions for all that we learn for the rest of our economics education. And so I had several interactions that were really loud with the professor of this class. And I never got kicked out. Actually, she was really kind. But I just remember these shoes so well what that represents. Here's me having a breakdown in the cafeteria, which was right next to Chase Bank. Chase Bank was inside of the cafeteria at UCSD, and there was this one day when they were passing out Sharpies. And the Sharpies were supposed to lure students in to get a credit card. And so I ended up getting underneath the table that had the blue tablecloth that where the Sharpies were and not moving. And the Department of Student Health came and spooned me until the paramedics came. And they were all standing around me, and like the managers of the building came, and I just sat up and I was like, I'm fine. This place isn't fine, it's f***ed up. And I told them why, and it was a pretty amazing moment. So I feel like I kind of got to break through some of that fog.
You are listening to an artist named Cassie Thornton giving a lecture at the Evergreen State College last October. Thornton's work focuses on debt and finance. She works under the title of the Feminist Economics Department. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's return to more of Cassie Thornton's talk.
Beginning in grad school again, after I'd been kicked out of the financial aid office, I was just feeling really frozen in school, and I remember being in this drawing class where I felt like I just didn't have any interest in drawing. I didn't even want to, like, touch it because it felt like it was such a part of a dirty market. And finally I had an idea to make a drawing. It was like the last day of class, of drawing class, and I was supposed to show something. So I asked if everybody could wash their hands, and then we're going to go do a drawing together. And so we went to the financial aid office, and we went to the waiting room, and I asked everyone to just touch everything. Just touch everything as much as you can, make it big, and try to find as much dirt as you can. And so these people are kind of like doing really cautious contact improv with the financial aid office, just like touching, like, you know, underneath the table or like where the brochures go or like by like the electrical outlet. It's like really, you know, it's really dusty and dirty, but this room was so white and like IKEA modern and stuff. So it seemed so clean and sanitized, but it was like so dirty. And so we made this drawing with all the dirt, and I thought it was like so awesome, you know, it was like so clear to me. Like, and all the students in the room were like, yeah, it's like corruption, like we got dirt on them. And I'm like, actually, I just think it's skin cells. I think that it shows that we are at the center of what the financial aid office is supposed to be doing. We're humans, it's a human place. Financial places are human places, even though it doesn't feel like that. And so what ended up happening is that I did end up going to New York. I had a show at this amazing old nonprofit called Flux Factory in Queens. And they asked me to do a performance project, so I did. I hired 20 dancers to go to 20 banks and to touch everything. And so we practiced, here's us on the outside of Chase Bank, where they're cleaning always, all night. And we just started by making small mistakes, like just touching things. And then we tried to make other mistakes, like here's one person using an ATM, and then here's two people using an ATM, and here's four people using an ATM. And so we're all practicing these little nervous experiments where we could just barely break the rules. I mean, it just broke us to break the rules because we were so scared and shaking. But eventually we began to start to be able to do slightly larger actions. So eventually we built up until we were really comfortable going to banks together. And our system was we would wash our hands outside of the bank together with a bucket and a soap, and then we'd go in, and there was between like 2 and 7 people usually going to the bank together. And then when we got inside, we would just ask the person in the front, oh, well, we would like to open a collective savings account. And they'd be like, oh, okay, just a second. And then they'd go get the banker. And meanwhile, we're touching. And then the banker comes out and brings us to their office, to the back of the bank, and you know, they're like, well, so what's a collective savings account? And meanwhile, you know, it's like touching. And you know, we got really good at being like, well, we're performers and we're doing this project and we just need to all have access to the same funds because we're raising money. And they'd be like, well, so like, what's the project? What are you raising money for? And we're like, well, Well, it's this. And they'd be like, so where, what do you mean this? Where does it, when does it happen? Like, well, now. And we ended up opening 20, you know, all 20 of the bank accounts. We opened all those savings accounts. And they all have between, like, some banks would let us open, like, five with five people on it. One bank let us have it with 11 people. And I still have all those accounts, like, sending me information, which is cool. But anyway, so we got really good at it, and it took us so long, though, to break through our own sense of, like, what was possible. Like, our own rules were so much tougher than the bank's rules. And we were so afraid of what could happen to us, but nothing ever happened to us. And finally, we had the guts to, like, step over our bounds. And what we did was we gave our bank account at this one TD Bank in Midtown Manhattan on 59th Street. We got a savings account there, and so we had a savings account number, and we gave this number out to tons of people. And we said, come and wait in line and make small deposits in our account, and that's a way to kind of watch what's going on. So for an hour, we're going to be performing, and you can come, and you know, you have this reason to be in the bank. And we filled the bank up. The line was out the door, and there's people on the floor touching everything. There's people, like, dumping the pens over, and, like, you know, it just became, like, just chaos. And then security finally came and got us and pulled us out. And I felt like it was such an amazing moment when we actually got strong enough to need to be disciplined. And so proud. So this is just some images of, like, the installation was at the Flux Factory, where these images of the handprints of the drawings of the dirt. We went to the Federal Reserve, to the museum. We were not allowed in the Federal Reserve. We went, you know, to banks all over, and so much developed out of that project. I obviously think about debt a lot, and I think that in talking about debt, I like to go with the idea that debt is something that is natural, that was not always corporate and was not always predatory. If we didn't have anything owed to anyone else, we would have nothing to do. We think of debt in this really flat way, like it's what I owe to the bank or to the student loan company, or I don't have debt, maybe you do, but I don't have debt. But I just don't think that's true. I don't think there's any living beings, well, I don't know about actually if animals have debt, but I don't think there's people that don't have a sense of owing or obligation to someone. And it does not necessarily mean that it's scary. It does not necessarily mean that it's oppressive. It's just a relationship. If you have me over for dinner, like, I want to do something for you, and I definitely want that relationship. Like, I want that feeling of striving to kind of please you, to meet you somewhere, to meet you where you are. And as David Graeber said, it was always there. Like, credit and debt, they were not preceded by barter. It was never just like a completely clean exchange. It was always, there's always a layover. You always had something that I didn't have, and I had something you didn't have. And maybe those things linked up. And money was actually supposed to make it easier to exchange after credit had become messy. So I've been, you know, really for years thinking that debt means more than we think it does. And I keep thinking about this part of this Octavia Butler book. It's in this book called Lilith's Brood. And Octavia Butler is a science fiction writer, if you don't know her. And in this book, a very minor, I mean, that's not minor, but it's sort of something you could almost miss. This one storyline in it is that the Oankali aliens in the future have come to Earth, and they've tried to kind of save humans. And half of the humans are threatened and escape them. And half of them are kind of like subsumed and sort of join the Oankali culture and their very strange conception of like gender and sex. And but the amazing part to me is that the Oankali realize, and the humans never really do, that the most potent healing thing that the human body produces is cancer. And that cancer is the thing that can heal humans. So the Oankali collect people who have the cellular mutation that causes cancer, and they harvest the cancer. They don't kill the people to get it, but they get the cancer, and then they use it to heal other humans. But the thing that they heal in the humans is the humans' desire for hierarchy. And I think it took me a few years for this to blow my mind. Like, I read that, you know, 5 years ago or something. But I think that the reason I bring it up is that these things that are the most toxic substances, the things that are the scariest, the things that you want to avoid the most, are probably the richest. And that's why I love the elephant in the room, because it's probably a pretty powerful elephant or a pretty powerful something. And so that's why the debt is so interesting and unknown to me, because I think I'm looking at it in this way. Like, I wish I was an alien, because then I could see what things really were.
That's the artist Cassie Thornton speaking at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I'm C.S. Song, and as I watched Thornton's lecture, many questions came to mind, questions she answered when she joined me recently in studio. After a short music break, we'll present that conversation with Cassie Thornton. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I recently sat down in studio with Cassie Thornton, a social practice artist whose work focuses on the impact of economic systems, including regimes of debt and finance, on what people do and think and believe. I asked Cassie what kinds of things Laura, the woman she hired while a student at California College of the Arts, the kinds of things Laura would say and express during her breakdowns.
She would bring up things about how expensive living in San Francisco was. She would bring up things about how she really didn't know how she would ever get a job given this degree and how much tuition was. And she would talk about sort of the general, like, social space of the school, how people aren't taking risks. Maybe they're using garbage in their art, and that they're really kind of happy being in little white rooms by themselves doing their own work because they felt like that was kind of all they could do or something like that. So she was talking about all the conditions in school and in the social space of the school that were representative to her of this sort of deeper indebtedness. And, you know, she would actually go up and approach people and be like, can you see what's going on? Like, what we're really making is debt. And your artwork is just a byproduct of that debt. And so can you see, like, what we're participating in? Can you feel it? Like, why aren't you saying anything? And people would just look at her like, you are crazy. Or they would look at her like, please don't do this. Please don't do this. Please don't do this. And so, it was a real mix. And I think, God, I can't even believe that Fedora, who's played by Laura Gold, I can't even believe, you know, what she kind of lived through in the coldness of people's responses or, like, you know, but it was really sort of this, like, magnified experience of the sociality of debt.
So if you were with her every time she had a breakdown, then what was that like for you to observe her expressing things that she was interpreting based on, or she was expressing based on her understanding of your situation, her hearing what you were going through and what your debt was like?
I mean, for me, it was extremely anxiety-provoking to watch her. I felt a lot of guilt because, in a way, she was performing what I couldn't perform, and she had told me many times that she was being me for me and doing things that I couldn't do for myself. And what she was doing was at times quite violent, like throwing herself on the floor or, you know, socially violent by crying or wailing or screaming in public in a place where things are very like seamed up and quiet and professional. And so I had a lot of guilt watching her and a lot of anxiety for the thing that I knew that she was kind of bringing to the surface, which is inherently a really uncomfortable thing. And also, this was before Occupy really blew up and made it possible to talk about debt and economic inequality. So it was really, really gut-wrenching. But at the same time, there's something about bringing something that is sort of underneath the surface to the surface that's also a total breath of fresh air and a total rush. So I was really proud of what was going on at the same time as I was feeling like I just wanted to sort of like scratch my eyes out.
So how would you evaluate the balance between personal and political in this particular project? How much of it was a kind of catharsis for you, a way for you to, or you to see someone else really bear their or your frustrations and anger at what was happening? And how much of it is, well, I have this political point and this political message that I really want to share with people and I want to convey to people? And how would you balance the personal issues and the political, the kind of the broader political issues with this action?
I think it's complicated for me. I think I'm in a special position where it's really personal and really political. But by that time, I don't think I was actually that riddled by my own debt. Like, I wasn't doing it for a sense of catharsis for myself. My political perspective comes from a personal desire to never be bored. I mean, I basically think that debt and people who are really obsessed with sort of like a sort of professionalization or becoming good economic players, I think those are the most boring people on earth. And I really want to interrupt that at the source. And so that's why I think educational institutions are so interesting as a forum for that. But yeah, I mean, all of these projects, it's interesting because I always knew I wasn't going to pay my debt. I always knew that I didn't believe in like money for corporate education. So in a way, I was sort of already healed. But I really don't want to be alone in that. And so this whole project has really been about trying to get as many other people on board with me as possible.
We also heard a portion of a talk earlier this hour that had to do with a project is called Physical Audit. You call it Physical Audit. It has to do with touching things, going into the financial aid department at CCA, going into banks in New York City to touch things. With automatic banking machines, there was some reference to it, but tell me more specifically what you and your group, your cohort, did in relation to these machines.
Yeah, so to begin with, we did a series of practices in ATM vestibules to kind of get ready for what was the larger project of physical audit. And so our practices were basically where I would come up with a series of scores or like sets of instructions or challenges for the dancers to kind of like take in and like embody and just, you know, play with and see what happened. But a lot of those things included just doing everything that a person has never done or never even imagined doing to an ATM, things that were very, like, very human. So just for example, one day we had one of the dancers bring a dog in. And so we brought the dog into the ATM vestibule, and there's about 10 dancers there, and they just rotated between like petting the ATM and petting the dog and petting the ATM and petting the dog. And so, I mean, I think all the things that we did were very much about just like making the financial space a living space, kind of by whatever means necessary. So other things were like more about a type of vulnerability. So we got the dancers to go into pairs, and one person had their eyes closed for the entire process, and the other person was sort of in control of the person with their eyes closed. They were sort of in control of that person's body. So the person that was being blind, gave their debit card to the other person and like let that person sort of control them as they made a withdrawal or had a transaction on the ATM. And, you know, that sort of thing where two people are both sort of together using the ATM, kind of interdependent, but also one has the opportunity to take advantage of the other, though they didn't. Like, there's some just playing with vulnerability that was really important. And maybe the most interesting one was just asking 10 people to use the ATM at once, and just sort of seeing, like, how the dancers interpreted that, like, what kind of inventions they made somatically. It was really kind of an amazing, it was really an amazing practice that evolved out of it, because I think that in general, we got really used to making the banks a place that we could sort of play, like continue the way that we live outside of the banks, inside of the banks, which is, you know, we're living creatures that, you know, explore and have questions and make mistakes and, you know, make messes. And so we really brought that into the bank.
Yeah. And of course, you know, there are kind of bank rules and there are mores as far as what people can do or can't do in banks and spaces that comprise banks. And you refer in this talk, portions of which we aired earlier this hour, about kind of breaking through you and the dancers, our own sense of what was possible. You say at one point in the talk, our own rules were so much tougher than the bank's rules. Elaborate on that.
Well, it was fascinating as an experience to go into banks to kind of play, because the first set of ideas we had were just that we were going to go in and touch as many surfaces as we could. And I found myself so nervous that I couldn't actually even extend my arm away from my body. I couldn't really do anything. And I saw it in the other dancers as well. The first couple times that we went in, there was so much fear of kind of like messing up or messing around that I think we were really, really stiff. And we kept expecting that a security guard would come or that the police would come, and nobody ever came. And so we had so much anxiety about, like, what was going to happen to us, like, when we went to jail for going into a bank and touching things. And then time after time, there was just, like, there's no discipline. There was not even any attention paid to us. If anything, like, people actively ignored what was happening around them. And so, you know, there was these times when I could see some, especially some of the more experienced dancers, going from being sort of, like, scared financial people to becoming like to sort of opening up and really interacting with the space of the bank. But I would say it took like 10 or 15 visits for some of us before we really started to be able to like feel a little bit free.
So how much of this project was about empowerment, maybe empowering people to act in certain ways that they wouldn't feel appropriate maybe beforehand, and how much of it was, and this is probably related, this sense of, you know, here's your body and there are ways you can use your body that you don't think you can use your body to express yourself in even public places in a way that can carry forth a message, whether it's to yourself or to other people?
Yeah, I think that it's both. I mean, for the dancers that were involved, I've stayed in touch with them, with many of them, and we talk a lot about how it was sort of like a practice of sort of undoing our own sense of what was possible given really sort of corporate, sterile places. So yeah, I think that part of it is really very much about unschooling our own obedience. And I think it really worked. And I think that we can see that because of what a lot of those people are still doing now. I think it seems as if people were really affected, because I think a lot of those people are still really involved in activism and a sort of very physical civil disobedience in their practices. But also, it is very much about a sort of like a training around alternative activist strategies. There's a lot of subtlety to what we were doing, and it was something that was like actively witnessed by a lot of normal people just trying to do business or go through their daily lives. And I think that in terms of just thinking through how to make a spectacle and like how to make a statement and the way that big finance and big politics actually like does become a material that you can work with in everyday life, like I think that it really did a lot for that. And yeah, so I feel like it's really trying to be a sort of somatic training for like activists to really think through like how we can inhabit space radically and like sort of stop business with our bodies.
Cassie Thornton is my guest on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. She is an artist, and we have a link to her website. It's called the Feminist Economics Department, or the Fed, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Tell us about the drawings and the handprints that emerge from this, right? So they're touching these surfaces that are sometimes dirty, and that interrogates certain things about corporate and financial spaces that I hope you'll talk about a bit. And then what would they do with the material on their fingers?
The idea was really that like the bank is a living space, and that this dirt actually is, it's not like we're gathering dirt on corporations. We're actually like tracing the ways that like living still happens as a part of these bad institutions. Like even though they're sort of faceless and you know, we can't sort of understand, it's really hard to understand these companies as like human companies that are actually made to serve other humans. This dirt, which is actually like, you know, a mix of skin and like stuff that people have dragged in from the outdoors and like hair, like it's really living material. So to get it on our bodies was like totally disgusting because there was a ton of it, but also like as sort of like engaging with the idea that the bank is a living place and that we could somehow take it back. So then we would, at the end, like before we left the room of the bank, we would take out a clean piece of paper and just all rub our hands on it. And, you know, the piece of paper would become quite dirt, like really dirty. Like it was like really like, you know, these are dusty, dirty places, even though they appear very, very clean and very sanitized and controlled. Like they're really dirty. And the rubbings are quite amazing because it almost looks like, you know, people would put their hands on them and sort of drag them down. So you have these kind of like, they almost look like windows of prisons or something like that, or walls of prisons where you would see like a hand like scraping down the side of it, like dragging down the side of it, trying to escape or something like that. So there are these really kind of weird and dark drawings. And as portraits of these very clean places, I think that they're really sort of intense and strong images to look at.
So Cassie, you've asked people, many people, what they would do if they had no financial limitations whatsoever, if money weren't an object. What have they told you, and what does that say to you about how important markets have come to be in our lives?
Well, when I asked people on the street how they would act or what they would do if they had no financial limitations, the answers were really disappointing. Like, you know, a lot of people said that they would go on vacation. One person said, you know, I would go to Europe. And I'm like, what would you do? And they said, well, I would eat really nice food. And then what? Well, I'd come back. After how long? Oh, I don't know, like a month. Like, well, then what? I don't know. Maybe I'd go on another vacation. And over and over again, I just felt like people's imaginations were like really stumped. And, you know, there were some people that were like, you know, involved in like sort of religious like charity work. And so, you know, some people wanted to like, you know, build stoves for people like living in Ghana. And, you know, that's nice. But there was a real lack of imagination. And it just feels like the cycle of personal debt just really keeps people working and on a really sort of individualized track. And it makes it really hard for them to imagine what they would really want if survival wasn't something that was so in question. But what I got out of that, and that when I was doing that, that was probably in 2012 or maybe 2013. But the state of things are just really hard, I think, especially for for everybody, but for people in cities when rent is going up so much and wages are not, there's just this sense of like, maybe I'm not going to survive. And so, you know, the imagination is the first thing that kind of goes out the window. The imagination goes straight towards like, you know, your bank account and like, what are you going to do to sort of like shake off the feeling that you have from doing a job you don't believe in all day? So much less, you know, it makes it even harder for them to become involved in like sort of having a political imagination about the collective. And I think that there's so many other factors at work with the anxiety that people feel around survival, whether it's what's happening in the environment in the sense that they can't really get their head around what, you know, what to be afraid of. I just feel like there's a sort of sense of impossibility and stasis, and everybody's little imaginations just gets like sort of like smaller and smaller and sort of like pushed to the periphery of their experience.
So what is the potential of debt to unite us, to bring us together, to bring people together who are suffering under debt, who are experiencing issues with debt and credit, which has kind of become, as I think a lot of your work shows or emphasizes, has become kind of a universal experience?
I don't know. I mean, I sort of standardly cite Annie McClanahan, who writes about social movements and debt, and she's an author that I see as being like really kind of ahead in terms of thinking about how debt really works, the potential of debt. Like, she really writes about the potential of debt in amazing ways. So she writes that when so many people have so much debt that they can never pay back, and there's just so many of us in that position, like the debt actually changes forms. And if it's no longer debt, maybe what it is just this like excuse for solidarity. And I think I still believe that. I think it's a really sort of slow process. But I do think that the process of untangling from our beliefs in and fear of financial institutions is ultimately like a really interdependent political process that I think a lot of us are in. And I think that there is a potential for actual forms of like new forms of solidarity to come from the degradation created by a debt system. I also think that there's a way that everyone, whether they have personal debt or not, is experiencing a really debt-ridden economic and social system. And I think it's a real challenge to figure out how to bring that out, because when we're talking about like municipal bonds to pay for schools or to pay for city infrastructure, we're not each getting a bill in the mail for like the debt that your city incurs to like give you the basic infrastructure that you would expect, like sidewalks or libraries or sewers. Like, we're not getting a bill for that. But we are all sort of experiencing the impacts of the debt system on the systems that we live with. So I think that there's a way that we're already sort of like in solidarity experiencing a lot of different forms of debt, ranging from personal to municipal. But I'm not exactly sure how to make it feel like solidarity when I think so much of what we experience of debt right now is completely invisible and buried. But I think it's a really important question to ask. I guess one thing that I've been thinking about a lot in the last couple of months is like, you know, we've really tapped into talking about student debt. And like, I think there's just a few years, we have like student debt movements that range in form, that reach all different populations. Like, it's totally amazing that we can talk about it now. We can talk about all the sort of injustices of, you know, various institutions, including educational ones. And that's totally amazing. But all in all, you know, there's all sorts of estimations about like how much money flows through for example, like public higher education, like maybe it's about like $60 billion for tuition for all public higher education. But okay, what about primary public education, like, you know, kindergarten through high school? Well, that's a $600 billion a year business. And so while we've all been really proud of our ability to talk about student debt in one way, about like our personal student debt and the way that that impacts, you know, jobs in the market, sure, like it's really important. But also, like, meanwhile, like babies are kind of entering a debt system. And so I find that there needs to be a whole new conversation about how this sort of undercurrent of debt can be exposed and still be used as a cause for solidarity. And I haven't seen how that can happen besides in places like Greece, Puerto Rico, and even in the Chicago public schools. But it's almost as if like that sort of underneath, like that public debt needs to actually like completely explode into bankruptcy or into some sort of like really crisis level situation before people begin to experience the solidarity that I think debt offers.
Cassie Thornton, she's an artist, a social practice artist whose work focuses on debt and security. She works under the title of the Feminist Economics Department, her creation, or the Fed. And we have a link to her website, the Feminist Economics Department, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Cassie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And since we have time, I want to read something that Cassie wrote that supplements something she told me during the interview. In the Australian publication Dance House Diary, she writes, "I've asked many people what they would do if they had no financial limitations whatsoever, and they typically say, go on a vacation to Europe and eat whatever I want. So anything is possible, yet what you say you want is a fancy experience of eating meat in some globalized city that wants you to invest in its generalized cultural capital and real estate, all so that it can secure its borders against people who cannot afford its fancy meat. That's not the person wanting. It is the market. It has possessed them and taken over their entire sense of reality and desire." And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.